Good evening, everyone. Thank you for joining. Welcome to Religious Zionism, what it means and why it matters. Today, I want to tackle one of the most difficult passages relating to Religious Zionism. It's one that we've referenced a number of times. It's come up in our past lectures, and that is the Gemara in Ketubot about the Shalosh Shavuot, the three oaths. There are actually six oaths, but three of them are particularly relevant. Before we do that, let's do a brief review of what we've seen until now. We focused on the last number of weeks on sort of the philosophical underpinnings of religious Zionism. And without with running the risk of being a bit too simplistic, I would summarize the three schools of thought as follows. The first is the school of Rav Kook and his followers, which is the notion that the return of the Jewish people to the land of Israel represents the first step in the process of the final redemption, that Eretz Israel is the place where we can be the people that we need to be. We can unlock all the spiritual forces latent within Eretz Israel and Am Yisrael, and this will bring all Jewish people together, religious and secular, until it will bring and herald the final redemption. That's sort of Cook's perspective, and we discussed some of the difficulties with that perspective and the radicalism it might lead to. The second perspective was that of Rabbi Yaakov Hyrynes, the founder of the Mizrahi movement, and it was almost the opposite. Rabbi Hyrynes is not focused on messianism or anything like that at all. Rabbi Hyrynes is, in fact, the opposite. Rabbi Hyrynes believed that this is not the way that Mashiach is going to come. God brings Mashiach, as we'll get to today. Hyrynes believe that the reason to move the Jewish people to Israel and establish a homeland there is more pragmatic. It's to defend them against the forces of anti-Semitism, which are forces that will not be defeated otherwise. The hatred for the Jewish people, augurs of Hyrynes, is intolerable, rather, regardless of what we do, hard as we try to assimilate, hard as we try to fit in, hard as we try to be citizens like everybody else. They still are going to hate us, and the only way to ensure a safe future is for the Jewish people to establish a homeland for themselves such that they can take care of each other and take care of each other's physical and spiritual well-being. And then finally, last week, we discussed Rabbi Soloveitchik, who on the one hand isn't quite a messianist like Rav Kook. He sees the state of Israel as potentially a stepping stone toward the final redemption, but it's not the emphasis. Soloveitchik certainly did focus on themes of anti-Semitism as well, but he also sees the state of Israel as an expression of what the Jewish people can be, and the ability of our people to live as our own nation, unfettered from the pressures of society, where we can live out our halachic destiny, where we can run a state based on our Torah values. And we discussed that doesn't necessarily mean that everyone's going to keep halacha. Rabbi Soloveitchik says it's going to be hard research figuring out how a state can operate with halachic values, but that's the initiative. We have to figure out how, in dealing with all sorts of walks of life, all the things that a state needs to deal with in terms of economics and the military, all those things need to be geared toward Torah values, and that's what's beautiful about the state of Israel. So thinking about all those three perspectives, we come to a Gemara today which is very troublesome. A Gemara today which suggests, at first glance, that maybe we shouldn't be going back to the land of Israel at all. That we're not supposed to go back until God tells us to go back. And before that point, we need to stay where we are. And as we look at this Gemara, I'd like you to think about how you would understand this Gemara, how you might read it generally, what is the message the Gemara is trying to convey, what's the point of the Gemara, and specifically how you might look at this as a person who is committed to the religious Zionist mission of establishing a national homeland in the land of Israel for the Jewish people. And so with that, we begin with our source sheet. I will attach the link in the chat once again. I hope it is accessible. And we will begin with a pasuk from Shir HaShirim, which will end up being very consequential. And then we will begin with the Gemara. If you look at source number one, the pasuk in Shir HaShirim, the Song of Songs, writes as follows. Hishpati etchem b'not Yerushalayim. I adjure you. Shvuah also means an oath. I make you take an oath, daughters of Jerusalem. Bitzvakot o bialot hasadeh, by the gazelles or by the hinds of the field. Imta'iru v'imta'oreru, do not wake or rouse et ha'ava, the love, ad shetechpats, until she is desired. God in this passage tells the people of Israel that there's a certain love, a love that they're not supposed to awaken before the appropriate time. And this brings us to the famous, or maybe even if you could say such a thing about a Gemara, infamous Gemara in source number 2. You may be really familiar with this Gemara. If you're familiar with Satmar Hasidus, this is what their source that they talk about when thinking about Zionism. They're very anti-Zionist. And it's important to appreciate the context here, which is really interesting. The context of this Gemara is about how amazing the land of Israel is. That's what this Gemara is all about. How wonderful and awesome the land of Israel is. How important it is to live in the land of Israel. Take a look at the beginning of the Gemara. And there are a number of statements to this effect. This is just one of them. La'olam yador adam be'eretz Yisrael, afilu be'ir sheruba ovdei kochavim. Says the Gemara, a person should always live in the land of Israel, even in a city which is mostly inhabited by idolaters, va'al yador b'chutzla aretz va'afilu b'ir sheru b'Yisrael, and don't live outside the land, even if it's going to be in a Jewishly populated city. Better to live in Eretz Yisrael surrounded by idolaters than to live in the middle of Toronto where there is a whole Jewish community, or to live in New York City where there's lots of Jewish people, or in England. Better to live in Israel, says the Gemara. And the Gemara makes quite a striking statement, which I'm not going to focus on for now, but it speaks to how important it is to live in Israel. Shekol hadar b'Eretz Yisrael dome kimi sheyesh lo eloka. Anybody who dwells in the land of Israel is comparable to one who has a God. That anyone who lives outside the land of Israel is comparable to one who does not have a God. And Mefarshim explained briefly that there's a unique connection that a person gets when they live in the land of Israel. It's God's real estate, as it were. It's the place of the Makom HaMikdash. And so you are so connected to Israel that in comparison, connected to God there, and in comparison, someone who lives outside of Israel is as if they have no God. So that's the context of this Gemara, all about how important it is to live in Israel. Which brings us to the conversation between Rabbi Zerah and Rabbi Yehuda. And as we go through this Gemara, we'll have to keep track of the two characters. There's Rabbi Zerah and Rabbi Yehuda. Says the Gemara. You can follow along in the English. Again, in source number 2. Rabbi Zerah hava kamishtamit minei de Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Zerah was trying to escape Rabbi Yehuda. Why? You know, you might have a time where you're with your rabbi and you're a little bit embarrassed about something that you're going to do. You don't want the rabbi to see. So Rabbi Zerah had something he didn't want Rabbi Yehuda to see. And I don't mean that in any way right now. Like, there's nothing you have to hide from me. Like, this is a safe space. But Rabbi Zerah had something he wanted to hide from Rabbi Yehuda. What did he want to hide? Well, the Gemara says, the Ba'ala Mesach l'Eretz Yisrael. He wanted to make Aliyah. He wanted to go to Eretz Yisrael. And he was hiding this from Rabbi Yehuda. Why was he hiding it? To Amar Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yehuda says, Kol ha'olem yibavel l'Eretz Yisrael over ba'aseh. Of course, the Gemara is written in Babylon. The Gemara is a description of the rabbis, primarily of the rabbis who were in Babylonia and the yeshivot that were in Babylon and their discussions. So Rabbi Zerah is in Babylon. He wants to go to Israel. And Rabbi Yehuda held that anybody who ascends to Israel, anybody who makes aliyah from Bavel, over ba'aseh, transgresses a positive commandment. Shana Emar, as it states in Yirmiyahu, Bavela yuva'u v'shama yihiyu ad yom pati otam ne'um Hashem. They will be brought to Babylon, and there they will be until the day that I recall them, said the Lord. Says Rabbi Yehuda, look, I have a pasuk in Yirmiyahu. It's telling the people that in Babylonia to stay there. Stay there until God calls you back. So says Rabbi Yehuda, you are not allowed to make Aliyah from Bavel. And therefore, Rabbi Zera, when he wanted to do so, was avoiding Rabbi Yehuda. It was awkward because he didn't want Rabbi Yehuda to pester him about making Aliyah. Okay. But if that's so, then what is Rabbi Zera thinking? If it indeed is a positive commandment based on the verse in Yirmiyahu, why is it that Rabbi Zera feels like he can make Aliyah? What's going on? Says the Gemara, what about Rabbi Zera? And now here I have line by line in the dialogue. Rabbi Zera, what was Rabbi Zera thinking? Hahu b'kli sharektiv. Rabbi Zera says, no. That pasuk telling us that we have to wait until God remembers us to ascend from Babylon, it's not talking about us. It's talking about the utensils, the vessels. The vessels from the temple that the Babylonians took from the temple and they brought to Babylonia, those vessels are going to be in Babylonia until God remembers the Jewish people and brings them back. But there is no reason not to make Aliyah. That's the first line. Okay, that's a good point, Rabbi Yehuda. What about Rabbi Yehuda? If that's a good point, maybe it is talking about the utensils. Arise, Rabbi Yehuda, say you can't make Aliyah. Ketiv kra'acharino. Hispati etchem b'not Yerushalayim b'tzva'oto b'alot ha'sadeh. He quotes our pasuk from source one. There's another pasuk. The pasuk says that God makes the Jewish people, the daughters of Jerusalem, swear not to awaken the love. Rabbi Yehuda says, what does it mean to awaken the love? To not make Aliyah. Don't go back to Israel until I tell you. That's what it means. Okay. So what does Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Zera think? Rabbi Zera, ha-hu, and here's a very important line, shalo ya'alu Yisrael b'choma. What does it mean that hispati etchem, what is God making us swear to not to do? It's lo ya'alu b'choma. They shall not ascend in a wall or above the wall. What does it mean to not ascend above the wall or through the wall? Take a look at Rashi in source number 3. It says Rashi on this statement in the Gemara, Yachad biyad chazaka, together with a strong hand. So essentially, Rabbi Zera comments to Rabbi Yehuda, listen, what are you not allowed to do? You can't have the Jewish community together by force ascend to the land of Israel. That's what you can't have. I am not the whole Jewish community. I am an individual that is going to the land of Israel. I'm not fighting anyone. That is permissible. It is permissible for an individual to go to the land of Israel. The problem is if the Jewish community as a whole ascends to the land of Israel by force. I know some of you are looking at this line and thinking, uh-oh, you can't ascend to Israel as a community by force? Well, what do we make of the modern state of Israel? Well, we're not done yet. Rabbi Yehuda, Hispati Acharina Ketiv. Yehuda says, okay, listen, I know that there's one pasuk that's there to teach you that a community cannot move to the land of Israel by force. But believe it or not, the same exact verse is written again in Shir HaShirim. This verse, Hispati Etchem B'not Yerushalayim, is written twice in Shir HaShirim. And says Rabbi Yehuda, the second verse is to even forbid individuals from moving from Bavel to Eretz Yisrael. And still I think you shouldn't go, Rabbi Zera. Right? They're having this conversation back and forth. Don't go, go. So Zera says, no, even that's not enough. Rabbi Zera, what's Rabbi Zera do with the second verse? So I'll tell you, Hahu mi bayalele kidder Rabbi Yosi b'Rabbi Chanina. That's for something else. And here's the kicker. The Amar that he said, Gimel Shvuot Halalu Lama. There are three times in Shir HaShirim where the words Hishpati Etchem are said. What is the purpose of these three oaths? Says the Gemara as follows. Acha, the first oath, Shalo Ya'alu Yisrael b'Choma. Again, as we said, the Jewish people should not ascend in mass, by force, the land of Israel. Va'achat, the second, Shehashbiya HaKadosh Baruch Hu Yisrael, God made Israel swear, Shlo Yimridu B'umot HaOlam, they shall not rebel against the nations of the world. They cannot rebel No rebelling. That's the second oath. Okay. And what is the third oath? The achat sheshbia kadosh baruch hu et ha'ovdei kochavim shelo yishtavdu behen Yisrael yoter midai. Oath number three, that God makes the idolaters swear that they cannot so heavily subjugate the Jewish people more than necessary. They can't take it out on us so harshly in the exile. Three shvuot so far. We can't make aliyah as a community by force. That's oath one. Oath two, we cannot rebel against the nations of the world. Oath three, they cannot torture us excessively. Three oaths. Okay, so now Rabbi Zeira explained why we have three psukim. So now Rabbi Yehuda still doesn't have any verse telling us why it is that an individual cannot make aliyah from Bavel. Rabbi Yehuda, so what's now? Okay, Rabbi Yehuda, so why is it that you think this verse teaches that you cannot make aliyah from Bavel? Into Oru Tiv. If you look at each of these psukim, it says, if you look at source number one, there's two formulations. Do not awaken. Each of the double formulation of the oath comes to teach you that not only can the community not make aliyah, but also an individual cannot. And that's Rabbi Huda says, that's why, Rabbi Zera, I got you now, Rabbi Zera. Don't you dare move to Israel. The reason that you can't move is because it says a double formulation. Until finally, Rabbi Zera says, no, even that's not enough. Me violate kid Rabbi Levi. Rabbi Zera says the double formulation is necessary for Rabbi Levi. So Amar Sheshu Halalama says Rabbi Zera, there are three oaths. Guess what? There are six oaths, six types of swears that the Jewish people have to take, or five by the Jewish people, one by the nations of the world. Run. The first three are the ones I already said. Inach shelo yigalu etzakeitz. The other one is they should not reveal the appointed time that Israel is not supposed to publicize when Mashiach is going to come, assuming they get hold of that information. B'shelo yirchaku etzakeitz. They shouldn't distance the time for Mashiach to come. They shouldn't, Shalom Mepharshim explain, prolong it with their sins. B'shelo yigalu hasod l'ovdei kochavim. And they should not reveal the secrets to the idolaters. And then the Gemara concludes, b'tzva'oto b'alota sadeh. When these verses refer to the animals of the field, that we swear by the animals of the field, what does that mean? It's pretty harsh. Amar Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Elazar said, Amar lehem HaKadosh Baruch Hu li Yisrael, God says to Israel, Imatem mekaymin et ha'shva mutav. If you uphold my oaths, you keep the shvuot, good. Then it'll be good. Ve'im lav, if not, ani matir et bisarchem kitzvaot u'kailot hasadeh. I will allow your flesh to be harmed just as the animals of the field. You're going to get it if you violate the three oaths, says God. Don't violate. Be careful. Right? So again, we had this Gemara about how wonderful it is to live in the land of Israel. It's so important. Then we have this back and forth by Rabbi Zera and Rabbi Huda, where Rabbi Zera introduces these three oaths where God says that we cannot communally move to Israel by force. And he warns us that if we do, it's going to be bad news. And guess what? You know what the Gemara goes back to talking about right after this discussion? Well, says Rabbi Eliezer, Kol ador ba'aretz Yisrael sharai b'lo avon. Anyone who lives in the land of Israel lives without sin. You live in Israel, no sins. Right back to the topic of how wonderful it is to live in the land of Israel. So this is a bit of a confusing and troubling Gemara, is it not? We have this description of how wonderful it is to live in Israel, this back and forth between Rabbi Huda and Rabbi Zera. Rabbi Zera introduces these three oaths, preventing the Jewish people communally from rebelling against the nations of the world, and also from making aliyah en masse by force communally together. And again, we go back to talking about how wonderful it is to live in the land of Israel. So, I know that was a lot, but focusing on the three oaths and this Gemara's context, how do we read this? What do we do? How do we justify the state of Israel? How do we justify the first and second and third Aliyahs? How do we justify the Jewish people as a community going to Israel and even fighting a war of independence? Doesn't that violate this Gemara? Are we violating this Gemara? Do we have the right to say, okay, you know what? That's great, but we need to do it anyway. Is that the point? How do we understand this? Any thoughts? Any thoughts of how this might be reconciled with what we actually have done? How do we justify Zionism based on this Gemara? What do we think? Any thoughts in terms of the context or any ways to limit this Gemara? I know a bunch were mentioned in previous classes. Believe it or not, so we'll start off with the bad news, I guess. There are those, although they're not many, There are those who look at this Gemara and say, yeah, you're right. Based on this Gemara, all the sources about how wonderful it is to live in the land of Israel, all the sources about the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, which we'll learn about as we go forward in our series, all those sources are no longer applicable. They no longer apply after God exiled us, man of Israel. All of them will only apply when Mashiach comes. Of course, if you're familiar with the Neturei Karta, that's what they believe. Based on this Gemara, they made a whole philosophy. Everything is a problem until Mashiach comes. And there's a philosophy there, too, that we're not supposed to do anything. We don't do anything to bring Mashiach. We wait in the exile until God says, okay, guys, time to come back. That's how they look at this Gemara. And the truth is that there are certain sources that do look at this Gemara this way. Says the Megillat Esther in source number 4. Rabbi Yitzhak de Leon wrote a commentary called Megillat Esther. And in this commentary, he has a comments on all the mitzvot, the 613 mitzvot that the Rambam counted, and also the mitzvot the Rambam did not count. This comment is on number 4. There are a list of mitzvot that the Ramban attacked the Rambam for not counting. And one of them is the mitzvah of living in the land of Israel. The Ramban says, the Rambam, when the Rambam, I mean Moses Maimonides, made the list of 613 mitzvot, he left one out. You know which one he left out? The Rambam doesn't count the mitzvah to live in the land of Israel or to settle the land of Israel. He doesn't count it among his 613 mitzvot. Now, he does mention Yishuv Eretz Yisrael throughout his works, but he doesn't count it as a mitzvah. The Ramban says that's wrong. The Rambam was incorrect. There is a mitzvah, one of the 613, which we'll get to in the following weeks, to conquer the land and to live in it, the Ramban says. The Rambam left out this mitzvah. It was an omission. It was wrong. And the Megillat Esther in source number 4 is explaining to us why the Rambam left it out. Now, there are many explanations for this, but this is Rav Yitzhak de Leon. Says, I'll read it in English. It appears to me that the reason the Rambam didn't count the mitzvah to inherit the land and settle it is because it only applied in the time of Moshe and Yeshua and David, as long as they were not exiled from their land. But after they are exiled from their land, the mitzvah isn't applicable for the generations until the Messiah comes. For on the contrary, we were commanded, based on the Talmudic Tuvot 111a, that we shouldn't rebel against the nations to go conquer the land with force. Says the Megillat Esther, I'll tell you why the Rambam didn't count the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. You know why? Because it's no longer applicable. That's what the Gemara in Tuvot tells us. No more mitzvah moving to Israel. It's finished until Mashiach comes. That's his conclusion. Now, many do disagree with this conclusion. My question is how? Thinking about the context of the Gemara, of moving from Bavel to Eretz Israel, of the oaths God made the Jewish people and the other nations of the world swear, how do we look at this Gemara? Or let me ask you another question. How do you understand the notion that God made the Jewish people collectively take an oath? What does that mean? Or what might that mean? What problems are there with the notion that God made all of us swear? I'm looking for a simple question here. When you hear that the Gemara says that God made the Jewish people swear something, what question might you ask about that? Double here, Martin. Go for it.
How do you ever assemble everybody together except at Mount Sinai in order to make an oath? Excellent. How do you know that they have made an oath?
Yes, thank you.
If we're so scattered, who's going
to... How did this oath even happen? Exactly. Brilliant question. I didn't take any oath. I don't know about you. I never got there and said, you know what, Hashem, you're right. I hereby take an oath that I'm not moving to Israel. When did this oath happen? Where did it happen? And to Ralph's point, we know there are certain oaths that we took at Sinai, or Moshe made us take oaths. But those... He actually makes us say, Na'aseh v'nishma, right? Where do we make this oath? So that's one problem with this Gemara. Anything else? Think about the oaths that that God made us and the other nations of the world swear. And what do you notice about them? Or if I asked you, did everybody keep their part of the bargain?
Does anybody ever?
Right, exactly. Well, another issue is God made the other nations swear that they wouldn't torture us excessively. I am pretty sure they did not fulfill that oath. I am pretty sure that they tortured us excessively. I am sure that is the case. So there's that also. And there's also another thing. Right? What is the Gemara talking about? Moving from Babylonia to Eretz Israel. Maybe there's something specific about that context. So let's take a look at a few of these approaches. With the rest of our time, I'm going to argue as follows. First, I'm going to argue that there are a number of reasons to, on a technical level, reject the applicability of the three oaths to the current situation, land of Israel. There are a number of reasons, a number of ways of looking at this Gemara and saying, no, that they're no longer applicable, that we do not have to follow these oaths anymore, at least. But even after that's done, even if I convince you that we do not have to follow these oaths telling us not to move to Israel, there's a more fundamental point here that I want to talk about, which is, what should our perspective be toward this movement? Is it indeed true that we're not supposed to take concrete action as a people to move back to Israel and to begin get the wheels turning toward our redemption? Is that indeed the truth? And if it is indeed the truth, then how do we look at the current situation? And if it's not the truth, how do we look at this Gemara? So those are the questions I want to tackle. Let's look at some of the answers to this. The first answer to the reason the three oaths are no longer applicable is what Ralph sort of got at, which is, it's clearly not meant to be taken literally. How do I know it's not meant to be taken literally? Because I literally never took any oaths to this effect. And neither did you. I am willing to bet. So it cannot be taken literally.
So then what is, if it's not an oath, what is it?
Okay, good. So what is it? It could be a metaphor. What is a metaphor? That's exactly what we need to answer. The first answer is essentially that it's just sort of this notion, a spiritual notion. That's Rav Avram Borenstein, also known as the Avi Nezer, the Sagachover Rebbe, was a Hasidic rabbi. And he looked at these oaths and he said that these oaths were not administered in any literal sense. It's sort of an intuition that God gives to your soul. It's sort of similar to the Gemara, which says that, you know, when God teaches every baby before they're born, he teaches them the Torah and he makes them swear they're going to be a tzaddik and not a rasha. Now that doesn't actually literally mean that God makes the soul before it ascends into a body, take an oath. It means that God puts a certain good nature in every single soul, right? So in the same sense, that's what's happening here. Briefly, take a look at source number 5, read the English. the oath of the nations of the world was for the ministering angels of each nation, that they should not incite their nation to enslave Israel too harshly. In a similar way, we can explain regarding Israel's oaths that the oath was administered, excuse me for the typo, to the root of their souls above. This is an oath administered to your neshama. It's something that you don't even sense. It's unconscious. This is why it says, I adjure you, daughters of Jerusalem, for they are the souls, as the Zohar writes, quote unquote, quoting from Shir HaShirim, the daughters of Jerusalem, these are the souls of the righteous. And this is why he explains that the Ramban and all the authorities didn't bring the five oaths. And this is some pretty strong evidence. We have a lot of different halachic authorities. A lot of rabbis who through the centuries compiled the halacha. We have the Shulchan Aruch, we have the Rambam, we have Rabbi Yitzhak Alfasi, we have later sources, Ashkenazic sources, Sephardic sources. Almost none of them even mention this Gemara. It doesn't even make it to the final edition of the Code of Jewish Law at all. While the Code of Jewish Law has all sorts of laws on the books, even though it wasn't so applicable, about the importance of moving to Israel, there are all sorts of laws relating to each of Eretz Yisrael in the poskim. Barely none of them even mention this Gemara at all. Why? Why not? I'll note something else. Even though this Gemara is an agadic in nature, it's sort of teaching us important lessons. It's not legal, right? Many of the Mefarshim comment on all the nice statements about Israel, how wonderful it is to live in Israel, and they simply skip over these lines in the Gemara. If you're interested, you can look at the Meiri, you can look at the Maharsha, and Maharsha actually does talk about, we'll get to it, but the Meiri and the Rid, barely any of them even explain these lines. The reason why is because they're not meant to be taken literally. It's sort of an intuition that your soul has. That's what the Omni Nazer explains here. And therefore, he says, don't take it too literally. And in fact, Rabbi Yehuda Henkin here, and it is B'nai Banim, Rabbi Yehuda Henkin was an important posek, just recently passed away, and he writes, the Ramban, who does count the mitzvah of Yishev Eretz Yisrael, rejects this Gemara as binding. It's not binding. You can't tell me that after all the different Gemara, which talk about how important it is to live in the land of Israel, that all of the postgame codify in Jewish law, that because of one obscure text, we're going to throw all that away. Clearly not. So the first approach is, it's simply not meant to be taken literally as a matter of legal practice. Now, we still have to explain the metaphor, but that is one approach. A second approach is that of the Maharsha, other Mefarshim as well, who say, wait a second, look at this Gemara. What was this Gemara talking about? What was the original context? Where did Rabbi Yehuda not want us to make Aliyah from? Where was the place where we're supposed to wait, specifically? Anybody remember? It's the heading there in your source sheet, so.
Bavel.
Bavel. It's all about Bavel. Bavel is where the Jewish people were exiled to after the destruction of the first temple. Now, it's no coincidence that the Talmud, which is this work, is written in Bavel. And the Talmud Bavli often extols the greatness of the sages of Babylon and the yeshivot in Babylon and how wonderful Babylon was. And maybe this Gemara is specifically talking about Babel. It's not saying you can never make Aliyah from anywhere, even as a community. It's saying specifically that the people who were in Babel and stayed in Babel should not go back to Israel till God tells them. Why? There's something magical about Bavel, and I'll prove it to you. Look at this at the continuation of the Gemara in source number 7. Take a look at what Rabbi Yehuda says. Again, Rabbi Yehuda was the one who told us you can't move from Bavel to Eretz Yisrael. And then look at these two statements. Amar Yehuda Mar Shmuel, Kishem she'aser laseitz me'Eretz Yisrael of Bavel, just like you are not allowed to move from Israel to Babylonia. Wait, I can't move from Israel to Babylonia. You just said that I can't move from Babylonia to Israel. What is going on here? But he says, Just like you can't move from Babylonia to Israel. I mean, Israel to Babylonia. Huh? Asur let save me Babel Ashar, so you should not move from Babylon to other places. Stay in Babel. That's what the Gemara says. And then he continues. Amar Rav Yehuda, kol hadar b'Babel, k'ilu dar b'Eretz Yisrael. Anybody who lives in Babel, it's as if they're living in Israel. Whoa, that's quite a statement. What is so special about Babel? Says Rashi in source number 8. Kach asher latim yibavela fisha yesham yeshivot hamar bitzot Torah tamid. What's special about Babylonia? The yeshivot, the people who are learning Torah and teaching Torah. It's a makom Torah. Don't leave the makom Torah of Babel. That's what this Gemara is saying. And to this effect, the Marsha asks in source number 9. I don't get it. Rabbi Huda, you just told me I can't move from Israel to Babel. But you also told me I can't move from Babel to Israel. So what's going on? Which is it? Is it Israel or Babel? Where are we supposed to be? Says the Marsha, it depends. Where did you start off? If you started off in Babel and you left with the original exile, and we know that many of the Jews who were exiled to Babel stayed there and didn't go back to Israel with the building of the second temple, then you're supposed to stay. But if you're not from Babel, if you're from somewhere else, then go to Israel. That's the answer. Without looking at it too deeply. So essentially, the point is that this is not for everybody. These three oaths are geared specifically toward the Babylonian Jewish community because of the unique reverence that the sages of the Talmud looked at Babel with. It's specific to Babylonia. Now, I guarantee you, no one's going to tell you can't move from Iran nowadays, right? Like, no one's going to say that it's still forbidden to move from Iran in the 21st century. There are no yeshivot there. There's no shechina there. We were kicked out of Iran. So the whole thing maybe is no longer applicable if you do indeed take this approach.
Rabbi?
Yes, Andrew.
Is there a parallel in terms of historic relevance of the relationship between Babel and Israel and the rest of the diaspora and the United States and Israel today?
I think so.
Yeah, in terms of it's almost like insurance because there's the yeshivot and so forth in the United States. If anything, I mean, God willing, Israel's more secure today than it was at the time when Babel was a superpower.
Right.
But
I
think you know where I'm going with this in terms of the parallels. And there may 100%. Have been as opposed to it being a religious reason, this could have been pragmatic for survival.
It could be 100% that you find throughout, if there's a lot that's written about this, you find that there is certainly, although we like to pretend that all the rabbis always get along, we have a Talmud Yerushalmi, a Jerusalem Talmud, we have a Babylonian Talmud, and they take shots at each other all the time. In fact, there are Gemaras about them saying which one's better, Babylon or Israel, right? So there's definitely something to that. And I think you're right about your historical point. There were many times in history where the Jewish people found very comfortable place in exile, where there was lots of scholarship and flourishing and communal growth. And they said, this is the new Israel. It happened in Spain, in the golden era of Spain, before we got kicked out of there. It happened in Germany before we know what happened in Germany, right? This does happen throughout history. And this
Rabbi Brugman, I totally agree with what you're saying. But I think there may have been the parallel I'm drawing is there was also a military alliance. They needed Babel in terms of a backbone to support the coverings.
Right here, yeah, and they definitely were involved in politics in Babel too. They had relationships with the monarchy. It's a great point, but that's the Babel idea. Going to the next idea is an idea here by Rabbi David Blake in his Contemporary Halachic Problems, where he says, "Hold on a second, God made the nations of the world swear to not torture us excessively. They sure did that. If they ain't keeping their half of the deal, we don't gotta keep ours." Take a look at source number 11. There is yet another line of reasoning on the basis of which Rabbi Zevin, who was the author of the Encyclopedia Talmudic when it first began, denies the binding nature of these oaths. at the present juncture of Jewish history. He advances a forceful argument, which particularly in the present post-Holocaust era must find a sympathetic echo in the heart of Jews, who have witnessed an unprecedented erosion of all feelings of humanity among the nations of the world, which permitted the horrendous oppression and torture of the Jewish people. The Talmud records that two oaths sworn by the people of Israel were accompanied by a third oath, which devolves upon the nations of the world, namely, they shall not oppress Jews inordinately. According to Rabbi Zevin and the others who have advanced the same argument, these three oaths taken together form the equivalent of a contractual relationship. Jews are bound by their oaths only as long as the Gentile nations abide by theirs. Persecution of the Jews by the nations of the world in violation of this third oath releases the Jewish people from all further obligation to fulfill their terms of the agreement. Essentially, deals off. You torture us, we're going back to Israel. And that's the second approach to explain why these oaths are no longer practically applicable. Another approach is also historically oriented, and that relates to the definition of shelo ya'alu b'choma, not going communally by force. What does that mean to go by force, and did that happen when the Jewish people returned to the land of Israel? So here I brought you a quote from Rav Kook we referenced a number of weeks ago when we talked about Rav Kook. And think about Rav Kook's philosophy here. Rav Kook is the ultimate believer in doing what we can to bring about the reawakening and redemption of our nation. So how does he deal with this Gemara? Rav Kook does not ignore this Gemara. He explicitly says it is applicable, but what it means is something specific. He writes the beginning here, source number 12, read my translation. Behold, since it has already become clear to us that nothing in the principles of faith nor in its clauses will deter us from the idea that we'll begin to shake off the dust of our exile through our efforts in the ways of nature and the process of history. We don't have to wait for God to do miracles to try to redeem ourselves. Says Rav Kook, we can take practical measures to help ourselves. That's what we need to do. Because there's nothing wrong reason not to do that. The conclusion follows that there is a sacred obligation to attempt this in any way we can. Except, says Rav Kook, for one means, which nature itself, and we'll get back to this, teaches is anathema to us. That is, and he reference our Gemara, that they shouldn't ascend like a wall, and they shouldn't rebel against the nations of the world. And he says, these are two oaths. One, rebelling against the nations of the world, even without Aliyah, ascending the land of Israel is anathema to us. And we need a second oath not to ascend to the land of Israel with a strong hand, and here are the key words, without the permission of the governments as it was in the days of Cyrus. And here we can point to a very clear proof from history, right? We said these oaths apply to the people who went to Babel. The Jews returned to Israel, didn't they? As a community, and they built the second temple. Why was that allowed, pray tell? Weren't these oaths in effect at that time as well? They had been exiled. Why were they allowed to come back? Says Rav Kook. I'll tell you why. Because Cyrus, the king of Persia, encouraged them to go back. The oath, shelo yalu b'choma, or shelo yimadu ba'umo, means rebelling against the nations that govern us and fighting them and returning by force. And when Koresh or any government gives us permission, authorizes our return, that is totally in keeping with the two oaths that prevent us from returning by force and rebelling against the nations. Says Rav Kook. And that is indeed what Rameir Simcha Devinz, although I'm going to return to this later, but that is what many have argued. Since the Balfour Declaration in 1917, and further since the UN resolution in 1947, we have authorization from the nations of the world to return to the land of Israel and establish a homeland for the Jewish people there. Now, this is a bit tricky, because if that's so, well, maybe we should be bound, you could argue, to that the agreement that they authorized. But that is where Meir Simcha Devinz says here. He writes that there are, we'll look at the bold for the purpose of saving time, because I want to get to part of my main point. He says here, right before the bold, "Now, however, divine providence has brought us together, the League of Intelligent Nations in San Remo, and a dictate was established that the land of Israel shall be for the Jewish people. Since the fear of the oaks has been removed with the permission of the nations, the fear of the oaths, the mitzvah of settling in the land of Israel arises, a mitzvah equal to all the other precepts in the Torah." So the argument here is, once the nations of the world, the League of Nations, the United Nations, got together and authorized a national Jewish homeland in the state of Israel, the oaths no longer apply. That isn't considered by force. Now, we do have to use force once we get there and we make use of that permit and other nations attack us. That's true. But our return of the land itself was not by force. We waited until we were authorized. Now, it's not necessarily so accurate, because if you think about the British Mandate and the Haganah and the Irgun, you could argue that there was some force demonstrated and expressed there, but that's the argument nonetheless. However, I want to get back to another point that we made, and I think this will be impactful to how we look at what happens today. There are two more points to make, and that is, what is the nature of these oaths? So let's say they're not applicable today. Fine, we can take one of these arguments. But what's the point of them? What are they trying to teach us? What's the message? What is God telling us? Why did he make us, quote unquote, take these three oaths? What was the point of them? And there are two points that I want to make here. And the first comes from the Rambam in Source 14. Source 14 is a reference from the end of Igeret Teiman. Igeret Teiman was a very important letter the Rambam sent to people in the generation who were absolutely devastated. They were devastated because of all the false messiahs of their day. Throughout Jewish history, and certainly in the time of the Rambam, there were many people who claimed to be messiah, gathered a whole movement behind them, and ultimately totally failed, committing all sorts of sins in the process, or getting jailed or killed. And this sort of movement would absolutely devastate the people and ruin their morale. Because here they are, waiting in exile, persecuted for so many years. Someone comes and says, "We're Mashiach," and then it's nothing. And the Rambam writes a letter addressing this phenomenon. And at the end of the letter, after going through all the different sources in the Tanakh, which predict this, he says as follows. And I'm reading the translation here from Boaz Cohen, which you can find on Safaria. "The prophets have predicted and instructed us, as I have told you, that pretenders and simulators will appear in great number at the time when the advent of the true Messiah will draw nigh. But they will not be able to make good their claim. They will perish with many of their partisans." And here's the kicker. "Solomon, King Shlomo, of blessed memory, inspired by the Holy Spirit, foresaw the prolonged duration of the exile would incite some of our people to seek to terminate it before the appointed time, and as a consequence, they would perish or meet with disaster. Therefore, he admonished and adjured them in a metaphorical language," metaphorically, not literally. It's a warning. Solomon is warning us to desist as we read. "I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles and by the hinds of the field, that ye awaken not nor stir up love until it please. Now, brethren and friends, abide by the oath and stir not up love until it please." And he quotes Tuvot. "May God, who created the world with attributes of mercy, grant us the privilege to behold the return of the exiles, the portion of his inheritance, to contemplate the graciousness of the Lord, and to visit early in his temple." What does the Rambam say is the point of this Gemara? It's not saying you can never move back to Israel. It's saying be cautious. It's saying that there are going to be people who are so anxious to end the exile that they're going to pretend to be Messiah or to take absolutely drastic, unwise measures to try to return to Israel when they are not called for and they are foolish. And it's not going to work. That's the point of the oath. Solomon is saying, if it's not time, don't pretend that it is time. Don't be a false messiah. Don't get carried away with these dreams of redemption when they are just false. And he's telling the Jewish people, don't be fooled by these imposters. But it's not an oath to not move back to Israel. It's a warning. It's a warning for us that we need to be careful. This is what the Alei Tamar explains to verse 15, where he says very simply, what's the point of the three O's? And this is, again, a reaction to the notion that the mitzvah of conquering and settling the land of Israel no longer applies. Says the Megillat Esther, of course it applies. These are two different things. Not going back to the land, what was the point of that? It's about not being foolish. Don't try to rebel against the nations and return to Israel when you don't have the requisite force, strength, and power to do so. When you lack the military might and the weaponry to go back. That is all it's saying. Be careful. This is going to take a long time. And you are in exile, and there are more powerful nations that are in charge of you. Don't be reckless with your zeal to bring the Ge'ulah and your sacrifice and unnecessarily cause your nation harm. There will come a time, but if it's not the time, you're not ready for it, it's not worth it. That's the point. And Rabbi Tzvi Ram, who gave a shir on this topic and I listened to a number of years ago, look back at verse 13, he said, maybe that's what Mer Simcha of Dvinsk is saying. It's not simply that, okay, the nations of the world gave us permission, so now we can go back. It's not that. The point is, the fear of the three oaths is no longer applicable. We don't have to be scared anymore. The three oaths are a warning to wait until it is wise to do so, but the time has come. And here, I think, is maybe the most important point. And I'm going to argue now that even though we support the notion of establishing a Jewish state in Israel, we still have what to gain from the three oaths. Let me explain. Because I believe what the three oaths are saying is we have to be aware of the fact that God takes a personal interest in directing the destiny of the Jewish people. And it is God who brings us into exile, and it is God who brings us out of exile. But the question is, when we say God brings us out of exile, what does that mean? And I don't think it means that he is going to necessarily only perform these incredible miracles through supernatural means. But maybe God bringing us out of exile takes place through the miracles that we have seen with our eyes that have taken place over the last 70 years. That the League of Nations and the United Nations allowing us to return to our homeland, and the miracles of the Jewish army gathering together and fending off larger nations and establishing the homeland, that is also God telling us to return. As we read about last week, that is the six knocks that Rabbi Soloveitchik was talking about. That's also a message from God. So that the three oaths are not applicable, not because they're not applicable in the sense that they don't matter, but because we're supposed to wait till God lets us back. Well, we waited a really long time, and maybe now is the time where God is telling us to go back based on everything that has happened to our people in recent history. And for this, I'd like to point you to the Maharal in source number 16. Because Martin asked, if they're not oaths, what are they? The Maharal says they're not oaths in the literal sense, they're decrees. They're gzeirot. And for time's sake, we're not going to read it inside. It's esoteric, that's the Maharal, right? What he says is, galut, exile, is an unnatural state. The natural state of each nation is to be in their land. But God wanted us in exile for whatever reason. And it's unnatural. It's not the way it's supposed to be. So naturally, it should revert to the Jewish people going back to the homeland. So therefore, God decrees that don't go back until it's time. It's a decree. God's saying it's not going to work. You have to wait until the time is appropriate because I want the exile to last for as long as it's supposed to last. Take a look at the Midrash in Source 17, which is a similar effect. Maharal quotes this. When Avraham is told by God, Yadoa Tedak Ger Yezaracha, you have to know that your nation, your children, will be a foreigner. There will be foreigners in a foreign land. He says as follows. Yodua Shanim Mefazra, know that I will scatter them. Yodua Tedak Shanim Mechatzah. God says, I will gather them back. I will confiscate them. I will redeem them. And I think the message to us is the importance of seeing God's hand in these events, which at first glance seem totally mundane, to be able to look at history and see the hand of God behind it, to see us as relying on God in our return to the land. Another, the Rav believed, Rav Soloveitchik believed, that in matters of Ashkafa, history can rule. Philosophically, history has dictated through a various means, through the divine agents of secular Zionists who made all these efforts to return to the land, and weren't aware of these three oaths. Through everything that's happened, God has made it clear that now is the time. We can't ignore what history tells us so clearly. And for proof of this, that God sometimes works through interesting means, through means that we wouldn't have expected, I'll leave you with the Radak. You know, the only one that says this, but he is one of the important that say this. The Radak was a Rishon, a commentator on Tanakh, who lived in 13th century England and also parts of Spain, and France. And the Radak was writing on the notion that we say every day in davening, Al Piftichu B'Nidivim. We say in the Hallelujahs and Tehillim, don't rely on nobility. The Radak says, what do we mean? We don't mean you can never ask for help or you can never receive help from a foreign government. What we mean is, even when you do take practical measures to help yourself, know that the ultimate success depends on God. That even as you reach out to foreign governments for aid, know that ultimately it depends on God whether or not you will be successful. I'll read you the English. Don't take confidence in nobility. Rather, if a person relies on other people, he should make loyalty to God his emphasis. But he should but put in the heart of the nobleman to help him. For he has no salvation without the will of God. A person can save his friend from tragedy, for only Hashem himself controls salvation. And he can bring it about through people, just as he brought about the salvation from exile through Cyrus. And here's the kicker. Also in the future, says the Radak, in 13th century, he will bring about the redemption of Israel through Gentile kings, and he will awaken their spirit to send them away, as it writes, that your brother from all the nations will bring offerings to Hashem, and this will be when Israel only confides in Hashem himself during their exile. So I think part of the point is, the kicker is, we do not reject the notion that God, that Hashem is behind when we are in exile and when we are not. But we simply believe that the events of the following are meant, that religious Zionists believe, that the events in the generations that we have experienced point to the hand of God, telling us that now is the time. And I think the message is, heaven forfend, God forbid we forget that this is in God's hand. God forbid that we think that only based on our military might that we will be successful. That we have to continue to have faith and to daven and to do what we can to ensure the spiritual welfare of the nation of Israel so that this can indeed be the first step in the final redemption. It's not guaranteed. It's not a guarantee. It depends on whether or not we fit the bill. A lot of things can happen, and it depends on God. So the final kicker is, the three oaths might be applicable, but the point, the answer is, the religious science movement is, that now is the time. God is telling us to go back, and we just need to make sure that that dream comes to fruition. Thank you very much. May it soon be speedily in our days. Thank you for joining, and have